Okay, so we are now recording, and I will welcome all. We're up to 20, so good participation so far tonight. We do have a number of questions in the queue, some shares, and a couple of follow-ups as well. So we'll start off with those, and I'll kick it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Hey, welcome, everyone. start off with a quick reminder about the recording. As you know, we make audio recordings, and they are posted to the club's website. So if you go to the Q&A page and you scroll down a little bit, you'll find the section which says our most recent Q&A session. And there you will find the PowerPoint deck and the audio file and the chat window. And if there's any special presentations, like last week we had a Google Docs presentation, then you'll find that one there too. A bit further down, you'll see for previous Q&A sessions, check the archive, and that will take you to a second page where all the previous recordings are listed in chronological order. So those are all available from the OPCUG website, opcug.ca. Okay, so the first item on the agenda tonight is a follow-up on the location for email addresses in Gmail. I think this was a question about transferring email providers, and one of the thoughts was to move to Gmail. And I'd mentioned that I couldn't find any contacts when I tried to export them. But when I sent email to people like Chris, Gmail found the email address, so clearly it was somewhere. But if you look at my profile here, you can see the contacts folder. It says it's empty, no contact yet. But a bit further down the page, there's a thing that says other contacts. And I found when I checked that was where all my contacts were listed. And Chris has an additional comment on that. Don't you, Chris? Oh, you're muted.
Sorry. I failed to remember what it was that I had information on.
It's this thing here. It fills it in automatically for you.
Oh, yeah. I think it says you receive emails or you ad hoc send to other people. It automatically creates something under the other contacts. And I actually I've got hundreds of email addresses that are in the other contacts folder. They haven't caused me any problems yet. And I guess they may prove useful at some point in the future by coming up with some email address for some obscure person that I haven't talked to in many, many years or something like that. So as it stands right now, I'm leaving it. But I guess a lesson to be learned here is that if you are having autofill of addresses that are old addresses for people or wrong addresses for people, check out that other contacts folder and see if there's an entry in there and delete it, and that might overcome the problem.
Okay, so next item is the immersive reader in Edge, and this is for Chris.
Yeah, when I got to the new Edge that's built on the Chromium engine, I went looking for the immersive, originally referred to as just reader mode. And it lights up when you're on a page that supports it. It's over by the toolbar and or the right end of the URL bar. And I wasn't seeing it all. And I thought, oh, did they remove reading view when they moved to the Chromium-based Edge? Because I actually really liked it when it was there. It removes all menus and ads and footers that have all kinds of links to stuff that you're not interested in typically when you just go to somewhere you want to read the content that's on that page. It turns out that in actual fact, the reading mode was still there, or the reader mode was still there, but they've renamed it to Immersive Reader. I don't know why. I guess it's a little bit more than just reading. It can actually talk out the page to you and things like that. Anyway, they renamed it, and it still only lights up on pages that support it. And I found that that was actually the problem, is it seems to be more and more pages are not enabling reader view on them, and so that control doesn't light up. I thought the Ottawa Public Library would be one that would be for sure allowing reader mode or immersive reader in Edge, and I wasn't seeing it, and then I found it on one of the subpages on the Ottawa Public Library website, and so they are supporting it in some areas. So it is there in Edge, the new Edge as well as the old Edge, and if you look, it's actually supported, it seems, in all of the browsers. So you'll see it in Google Chrome. It has reader mode. It is off by default, so you have to actually go to the URL you see on the screen right now, and then you can turn it to enabled. Firefox, Opera, and Vivaldi all have reader modes that are enabled by default. Opera and Vivaldi are built on the Chromium engine. Firefox is not. But they have it. I highly recommend that if you are a Chrome user, enable it. If you happen to hit a page that supports reader mode, it can be much more a pleasure to read the content on that particular page.
And another way to do that that sometimes is useful is to toggle JavaScript off. And there are usually add-ins to your browser that will let you do that.
Yeah, bear in mind that with turning off JavaScript, and I think I demoed this before, some sites, they do so much of their content through Java or JavaScript. Holland America, the cruise line, if you go to their page with their homepage with JavaScript disabled, you will get a totally blank screen. So if you go to some place and you're using toggling off of JavaScript and something doesn't look like maybe it's not quite right, you might want to toggle it on just to see if you're missing a whole bunch of content.
Yeah, but it can be really useful if it's a site that has dozens of pop-up ads and slide-ins and videos and all kinds of nonsense that you don't want.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, the next issue is a friend of mine, actually, who has a Dell laptop and is trying to plug in a second monitor. And the problem was he's getting no video input. And it wasn't being detected in the settings. And the laptop has HDMI out, but the monitor only has DisplayPort or DVI in. So he had to use a converter cable. So the question was, how could he troubleshoot what the problem was? And Chris had a bunch of ideas on that.
Yeah, I thought that this was an interesting problem in that it presents itself as, if we just look at it as a generic problem, how do you break down a troubleshooting process? And so I started off thinking that, well, this is something that if there is one component that is not functioning, can you easily determine it and, you know, then move on from it? So I thought first thing would be that if you can plug in using the same external monitor and the same cable into another computer and it works, well, you can stop looking at that as being part of the potential problem. And then you can look at, okay, it seems to be local to the computer and troubleshoot it from there. There are multiple pieces, hardware pieces involved. So you have the laptop video port. You have the cable, potentially a dongle if you have a separate port gender changer or technology changer going from a VGA to HDMI or whatever. The monitor itself, the monitor might have multiple ports on it for input. And so is it possible to validate each of those separately so that you can eliminate one by one by one potential problems and then hopefully narrow down on what it is causing the problem? Can the problem be circumvented by using a different port on the monitor was one of my thoughts. So maybe the port on the monitor was bad, but it might have different ports. So a lot of monitors now, they might have VGA, HDMI, and you know, DisplayPort or whatever. So can you try using a different port on the monitor? And you know, regardless of what caused the problem, if that fixes it, well, hey, you know, stop banging your head against the wall. Also on laptops, is there multiple ways that you can send output to the monitor? Typically, you just plug the cable in and the computer will be sending content out to the video out port, but maybe not. So check the manual of your computer. It might have a function key or something like that that outputs to it. And maybe it's just not sending a signal out. You know, is there some way that you can validate that a signal is actually going out to the port some other way? And so I had some things like, you know, checking to see by plugging the monitor into a different computer or any other available port on the computer. Check to see whether the laptop output port is working by connecting it to some other thing, like a smart TV or something like that. Uses an HDMI. Plug the monitor into second computer using the same cable, converter dongle. Try using another input. You know, so a lot of these things are just designed to, you know, narrow down where the problem is. Try another cable converter. And this is what actually solved the problem in this particular instance. When it was swapped out to a new cable, that's what fixed the problem. So obviously it was located, that's where the problem was. Does the monitor have a configuration screen where you have to actually choose the input if it's got multiple inputs on it? Maybe you actually have to tell it, you know, okay, I'm going to use HDMI or I'm going to use DisplayPort or VGA or whatever. Some laptops have that function key that you have to press to enable output to it. Usually older laptops, but it does exist. Win and P, that will normally bring up a screen that allows you to say whether you want output only to the laptop screen or only to the external monitor or extend the display across both or mirror the two of them. So maybe it was set to, you know, only put output to the local display. So that's always something to check as well.
As Chris said, my friend basically, he plugged the monitor into a tablet computer and the monitor was working fine. And then he connected the laptop using HDMI to his TV and that worked fine. So if the monitor's working, the laptop's working, then we have to narrow it down and say, well, it has to be the cable. And sure enough, when he goes and buys a new cable for $7, that was the solution. But Chris is absolutely right. There's a bunch of steps to go through to get there.
When Alan came up with this as the final fix, I was actually a little intrigued because DVI, which is what this cable is, it's HDMI to DVI. So obviously the laptop was outputting on HDMI, and the input to the monitor was DVI. There are a number of DVI standards. Now, I'm not really knowledgeable on the DVI standards, but my understanding is that there are some connectors that look the same, but they are not electrically the same. And so this might have been the problem, was that the old cable was to a different DVI standard. DVI is one of the worst for that. I think the one standard DVI has got, you know, about four or five substandards on it. Whereas HDMI, you know, pretty much, you know, you can plug in any HDMI to any HDMI and it'll work itself out. VGA to VGA, that's it. So I thought that was interesting that it was a DVI connector.
I think that was my question.
Okay.
Both the connectors are DVI-D.
Okay.
Now on the back of the monitor and on the adapter I have.
Okay.
Actually, Tom, that's not your question. Yours is coming up shortly. This is a different problem altogether.
Oh, that was Tom. Yes, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And about the DVA standards, you know what Chris always says, it always gives me a chuckle. We love standards. We can never have too many of them.
Yeah.
Okay. One of the members found a statement saying that all Core i5 desktop processors have 4 cores and no hyper-threading. Well, mobile Core i5 processors have dual core, 2 cores, and hyper-threading. What does that really mean to a person that's just a run-of-the-mill laptop buyer? So I thought this was kind of interesting, and it really breaks, there's kind of 3 things that we can think about. And multitasking, I know what that is, and multiprocessing, I know what that is. But multi-threading, I always had a rough idea what it was, but I really didn't know. So I did a little bit of web surfing to find out. And one of the ways to look at this is think about the good old days when we had a single core CPU and it didn't have any hyper-threading. And the chip can only do one thing at once. It basically does an instruction, finds another instruction, then another instruction. But we know that we can multitask on computers. We can run a word processor. We can have email client. We can check a web browser. And for us, it looks like all these things are happening at the same time. But in reality, what's happening is the operating system is basically time slicing the CPU time. So it's giving some time to each process in turn, but these things are doing thousands of calculations a second. So even though it's time slicing these different processors, it's happening so quickly that as far as we're concerned, everything seems to be running at once, concurrently. Now, if you have a computer that has multiple cores, then if you have 2 cores, then it can literally do 2 things at once, because now it has 2 CPUs, each of which can look after 1 set of instructions. So if we were running a word processor in a window, and we had a second window where we were exporting a disk to a video file, let's say we've edited a video file, and now we're saving that file to disk, and we're running a word processor at the same time, if our computer has 2 cores, then the word processor can run on 1 core, and at the very same time, the video is being written to disk using the second core. So they're completely independent operations, and they truly are concurrent. Supposing now we have a computer that's got just 1 core, but it's got dual threads. Well, what happens there is that as far as the computer is concerned, it looks as though the chip has 2 cores, but they're kind of virtual cores. And what they've really done is, in the hardware, there's a single core, and then there are 2 pieces of circuitry that do the instruction handling. So if you like to think of it, I mean, it's a bit more complex than that, but basically, one of these pieces of circuitry is pulling instructions out of memory and feeding it to the CPU. And the other core is taking different instructions and feeding that to the CPU. But the CPU can only do 1 instruction at a time. But if one of the jobs gets stalled because, I know, it's taking time to find what it wants from a hard drive or something, the other queue might still be feeding stuff fairly rapidly into the processor. So you get a bonus, if you like. So think about, let's have a word processing task. We've just finished a file, and it's a big file, and we've sent it to the printer. And at the same time, or just slightly after that, we've opened a second file, and now we're typing away, and we're editing the text in our second file. We have 2 threads. So the print job can be running on 1 thread, and the editing job is running on the second thread. But we know that single core can only do 1 thing at once, so what happens? Well, you've got to think about those thousands of instructions per second. Even somebody who can type really quickly, it takes a long time in terms of computing time for the finger to move from one key to the next. So the word processing task is going to be keyboard bound, essentially. It's going to be slowed down because we just can't input characters fast enough. And what that means is that when that job stalls because it's waiting for another key, the CPU can take instructions from that second thread where it's pumping data from that file and sending it to the printer. So both things seem to be running at the same time, but in real fact, the CPU is actually time slicing and switching between these two tasks. So if we have a multi-core CPU, then it can process both of our tasks concurrently. If it's a single core but multi-threaded, it seems to be running two tasks at once in our word processing application, but really it's just switching when one of the tasks is so-called stalled. Now, there are a couple of nice websites which describe all this stuff, and this one, I think, is Gary Sims. Gary Sims from Android Authority has a series called Gary Explains. And he came up with this analogy. If you think about an airport where you have a security queue, and you've got a whole bunch of people in two different queues, and they're going through that pre-screening process where, you know, there are people telling you put your bag on the carousel, in the tray, and take your coat off, and your shoes, and your belt, and all kinds of things. So there's two lines of kind of pre-screening looking at these carry-on bags and accoutrements. But at the end of that screening process, you have to go through a full-body scanner. There's only one scanner for two queues. So what happens if somebody's slow in taking their coat off or getting their laptop out of their bag? That pre-screening queue may get held up. But if the other pre-screening queue is running kind of normally, then those people can keep flowing through the whole body scanner, and there's no holdup in the body scanning process. So it's like having a single core with two threads, if you like. If we had a multi-core security system, then we'd have a full body scanner for each pre-screening queue, so that the two queues, the two jobs in computer jargon, would be being processed completely independently. So Gary Sims has a rule of thumb, and he reckons that if you have one core that has two threads, it gives you about a 25% increase. So you get like 1.25 cores for your one core with two threads. So if you had four cores, if you had a quad-core computer and it had hyper-threading, two threads per core, then it would be equivalent to about having five separate cores. So you get, there's your 25% bonus, if you like. But if you had four cores, like a quad-core computer with no hyper-threading, it would actually perform better than a dual-core computer with hyper-threading. Dual-core with two threads would give you four threads, but those four threads are really only 25% better than two cores. So that in general, more cores is better than having the same amount of cores more cores is better than having less cores with hyperthreads to make up the numbers, if you like. Four cores are better than two cores with two threads. And if you want to check all that out, then here are the various links to the YouTube videos. Gary Sims has got this one on what we've just been talking about, multitasking, multi-threading, multi-processing. And he also has a separate one on hyper-threading. And Linus Sebastian, the tech quickie guy, he's actually a Canadian. And he also has a thing on hyper-threading, which is another good video on how this stuff works. So I highly recommend those videos if you're interested in the differences between multitasking, multi-threading, and multiple cores.
I've pasted those into the chat window, and so they'll be available both in the presentation file as well as the chat on our website afterwards. You can copy them from the chat window now if you want. Tom also posted in from Wikipedia about multi-threading computer architecture. And Tom has a comment in there as well. Overall efficiency varies. Intel claims up to 30% improvement with its hyper-threading technology, while a synthetic program just performing a loop of non-optimized dependent floating-point operations actually gains 100% speed improvement when run in parallel.
I think it depends a lot on sort of what the threads share and what they have for their own usage.
Yeah.
I think it's the more complicated things that that get shared, and so if there's contention for those, then obviously one of the threads gets held up.
Yeah. If anything to do with benchmarking, it's like highly, highly dependent on the benchmark itself as to what result you really get.
Well, I think Tom's right. It's also highly dependent on the circuitry that the various manufacturers put in their chips.
And Joss had a comment as well. The mouse is an example of a kind of thread. Here are some details. The mouse port is connected to a chip that can send an interrupt signal to the processor, which for a short period, it processes some code to deal with the mouse cursor, then return it to what it was doing before. I think, strictly speaking, that's not anything to do with hyper-threading, but the concept of what's going on is certainly valid in a multiprocessing environment for sure. And we have a couple of comments.
Okay,
your presentation was amazing there, Alan, so it's good.
Yeah. Well, thanks to Gary Sims and Werner Sebastian, really, that's where all the information came from.
Yeah, I actually had multi-threading wrong. I thought of it as truly being almost like the threads actually executing at the same time. And so I learned quite a bit from reading those articles as well.
Yeah, it's that bit about the extra circuitry, but it's not a full core. That's why you only get 25-30% bonus.
Yeah.
Okay, our next question is to do with
Presumably it's the simpler things that are the smaller circuits that are independent to each thread, and the more complicated things that are shared and that have to be one or the other, that are essentially multi-processed. In other words, they have to wait for the other thread to finish using the central thing. So I think it may vary a lot depending on what the hardware is and which particular CPU you're talking to, whether it's Intel or AMD or somebody else.
Yeah, absolutely, because as you say, there's a lot of timing stuff going on too. Things are having to look for when things finish and when things are started and so on and so forth. So it really is very chip dependent. Anyway, in general terms, I think that's a reasonable discussion of it. Right, moving along, we have a question about the weather network. This is Orion saying that his copy of the weather network wouldn't open, and it gave an error creating a configuration file. And it was a weatherEye.daz, which is a kind of a zip file, which seemed to fail. And he tried restoring the previous version, but then he got an access violation in a DLL. And when he tried to delete or repair the file, he couldn't open the file. Several websites say that they have free download of a weather network app, I think, for Windows 10, but none of them are functional. And he also got a runtime error. And what more can go wrong, right? Which suggests it's a virus, although he has Kaspersky antivirus, which says the file's okay. Suggestions. And Chris has a suggestion. everybody else can think about it.
Yeah. I first thought that it was a Windows app, store app. And one of the neat things about store apps is if something goes wrong with them, you can actually fix them usually very, very easily. So if you go to settings and apps, and you'll have your whole list of apps there, and you see the slide, it shows that scroll down to, in this case, where you saw maps. And there'll be an option on it if it is a Windows Store app for advanced options. And if you go into that, you can do a repair. And I think there's two levels of repair that can actually be done, one of which basically reinstalls it completely, and one of which just tries to reset things that might have gone wrong. I've had a couple of store apps that did go bad, and this very quickly fix the problems, so you don't have to go through and uninstall and reinstall and worry about things being left behind when you did the uninstall and various things like that. The repair option now appears to be very, very robust. Unfortunately, it looks like it was not a store app, or for some reason didn't have the advanced options when you go to the apps list. And so I'm not sure if that means that it wasn't a store app or it was an earlier generation of a store app that just didn't support the repair function. I'm not sure. But it seems clear that right now the weather network is not available for Windows in any shape or form, either as a Win32 app or as a store app. If you go to their website, you know, they have apps for iOS and Android, but other than that, they don't seem to have anything. So personally, at this point in time, if it is not a store app, I would recommend if you have the install media already or the install file that you originally installed it from, I would try uninstalling and then reinstalling. But if you don't have the installation media at this point, I don't think there's any way that you can reinstall it. And I sort of wonder whether the fact that they don't have an app or a Win32 program to do that work anymore, whether that's really fundamentally where the issue starts and ends with. But, yeah, if anybody else has any other ideas of things to try, jump in, whether it's audio or through the chat window.
Now, the kind of workaround is just to use the website, of course, but that's not quite the same thing as having an app.
Or just use the weather app that's built into Windows 10. It's actually pretty good. I might do a demo of some of the things on that at some point in the future. I do have a quick tip coming up in a newsletter article at some point in the future. Okay, I don't see any... Michelin has something. Weather network, maps, satellite, radar works fine on my desktop. Yeah, that's just a website. So the website works fine. There's no problem with that. But it's a matter of having a program installed on your computer seems not to be an option anymore.
Well, no, there is a store app that shows the weather in Windows 10.
Not from the weather network.
No.
Yeah, there is the one that's built into Windows 10. It comes in the box, and it works quite well. And I think there are a couple of other weather apps that are available in the Microsoft Store, but the Weather Network seems to have dropped theirs. I'm sure they had it before because I'm 90% sure that I had it installed before.
Well, they did because I looked on Google. I looked on the Weather Network site itself, and as you say, they only have Android and iOS and TV. I did a search on Google, and I found a Weather Network page, but it didn't have a Windows 10 app. The Windows 7 link was broken. No, the Windows 8 link was broken, and the Windows 7 link was going somewhere else, so I didn't go any further.
Okay, I don't see any other comments in the...
Okay, well, so let's moving along then. This is Tom's question. Tom has a new... Asus TUF A15 gaming PC, but it has a few little problems. The mouse becomes jerky, but you can solve that by rebooting. That's handy. The mouse is a Wacom Graphire 2 pad with a mouse and a pen. Using the manufacturer's drivers made it worse. That's even handier. He's also added a USB-C dock with DVI-D, VGA, and HDMI out, but none of those are working, but the USB 3 socket is working. And also direct HDMI, which I take it is straight from the laptop, doesn't work.
That's right.
So, Chris.
My first thought was, because it's a gaming laptop, have you overclocked it?
Not at all.
Okay. Because that I know, as you overclock things, they tend to become less stable. So anybody who is using something that is overclockable, if you set it to run at a higher clock speed and you start to have problems, that's one of the things to check and back off on. So that's not the solution. So Asus has a live update program that they install by default, and I would check through it to see if they have any driver updates available.
I've just installed the driver updates. I'm going to have to call Asus because there's all these little things. I recall hearing in one of the reviews of it that the USB-C comes from one video set of hardware, while the HDMI comes from another, because the chip, it's the Ryzen 4800, has a kind of a mini GPU inside it, and as well the laptop has a 1650 NVIDIA in it. So I've heard that they come from different things, but I can't seem to find a way to choose between them or to get either of them working. You'd think one of them would work.
Yeah, that's right. Another thing, from a generic troubleshooting point of view, I would actually look in Device Manager to see if anything is flagged as being problematic in there.
I've gone through Device Manager and uninstalled and reinstalled. It doesn't seem to make any difference.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that, I guess, if you have multiple ports, you know, from a generic point of view, trying different ports. If you do have ones available, that's always a thing to try. With Wacom, I've had problems with Wacom drivers in the past. You said that they made the problem worse when you used the Wacom drivers. I would keep on top of Wacom because they do come out with updates, and they usually do address, you know, some of the problems. They certainly at one point did address the problem that I was having with a Wacom tablet and pen. And I've also found that Wacom is very supportive. So if you open a support call with them, they may be able to do something. They certainly seem willing to try.
I'll try that. The trouble is the Graphire is about 15 years old.
Well, so. My first experience with the problem, I was using my desktop one, which is an Intuos PTK 640, which is probably 10 years old, and they were more than willing to talk to me about issues with that particular drawing tablet. They charge a lot for the drawing tablets, and I think as a consequence, they tend to be very supportive of them.
Thank you.
I thought perhaps the USB dock could be an incompatibility issue. Checking the dock with another PC to see if it functions somewhere else. Is it, you know, actually a hardware fault in the USB dock? You know, just, you know, doing this slicing one thing off at a time sort of thing.
Yeah.
Checking with different monitors and cables when you're doing the graphics output, you know, as possibles. Again, I'm sure you've done this, but it's just as a generic troubleshooting issue that other people might think of as if they're running into similar problems. And then if all else fails... Yeah, calling us.
I'll be doing that tomorrow, I guess.
Yeah.
Waiting for this thing.
Yeah, certainly if it's a new one, I would hold their feet to the fire. And, you know, we put up with far too much, I think, in terms of vendors not following up and not following through on their products. And gaming laptops are not cheap, so they should be well supported.
let's hope so. Yeah, I have updated all the drivers and so on, and they do seem to have regular updates. But I kind of feel that's a function of it being a new laptop that just really came out in the last 2-3 months. So it's there may be lingering problems that keep on lingering.
Yeah, that could well be. I find that when they have brand new devices, you'll often see a flurry of driver updates over the next 3 to 6 months. So, but yeah, getting on the horn to them, and you know, they may be able to get you early access to some drivers as well that might not show up on their website for maybe months.
Yeah, it could possibly be due to this dock that just bought cheaply. It may be that may have something to do with it. But it seems to me the HDMI port working on it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Josh is suggesting maybe updating the BIOS might help.
I've gone through all the updates from my Asus. I've given them a call about something else before. I'll give them another call later.
Tom, you showed us the dock that seems to be the crux of the issues as everything's going through it.
One of the issues. It's got an HDMI and a VGA
right.
on one side and a USB 3 and a DVI-D on the other.
Okay.
And it's USB 3.
All right. Well, I gather you can't, okay. It's gaming laptop. Obviously, you cannot connect. You're trying to connect something else to it that it doesn't have a port for?
I'm trying to connect I've got four video screens, including the laptop, and right now I'm only connecting up one of them, and I would like to. I also have a 4K TV that I'd like to connect to, and in fact, when I go into the display settings, it recognizes that I have a 4K TV attached to the HDMI, but it doesn't show anything on my 4K TV.
Well, I mean, you may not want to go down this route, but I'm pretty sure Asus has a dock. I realize it's probably going to cost you $100 or more. But at least if you bought that and it still doesn't work, then you can literally point your finger back at Asus, or Asus, as my Oriental colleagues would like to refer to it as. And therefore, you know, you have one throat to choke, so to speak. Right now, Asus is going to come back to you and point at that device and say, ah, not good. And, you know, you have nothing to stand on, where if you buy a dock that's meant to work with your gaming laptop, which I'm assuming you paid some good bucks for, then you'll know.
Yep, that's one possible route for sure.
Okay. I would wait until Asus actually tells you that that's your only solution, though, because who knows? They might be saying, like, "Oh yeah, we've run into some issues and we're addressing it or whatever." So they may have some other approaches. So being the cheap SOB I am, I always recommend going the inexpensive route first and then spend the money if you have to.
Yeah, they got a universal dock.
Yeah.
Okay, so moving on to the most important question of the night, because this is mine. My computer is getting a Windows update, so I thought I would make a disk image backup. So I plug in my 4 terabyte external USB drive, but it didn't go ding, and it never came up in File Explorer. And then when I backed it up on something else, and then when Windows started up, it decided that it didn't have enough space on the solid-state drive. This thing's a baby computer, right? So it only has a 64 gig memory. it didn't have enough space, so it wanted me to plug something in that had 10 gigabytes free. So I put in my 1 terabyte portable drive, and it wasn't recognized. However, it's quite happy if I put in my 8 gigabyte memory stick or a blank 16 gig memory stick, and they work just fine. So my question is, why has it suddenly developed a selection bias for USB drives? Don't all shout at once. You have to unmute the answer.
You say your 4 terabyte drive doesn't work either?
Correct.
And that's independently powered, I gather.
It is, yes.
Now, my first suggestion was going to be that the 1 terabyte drive isn't getting enough power from your USB plug, but that shoots that out of the water.
It always used to work.
By the way, I also have a T100 TAF.
Yeah, Bob Walker does too. I was hoping he's run into this problem.
I presume that these drives work fine on other computers?
Correct.
Yeah.
And the 1 terabyte, it's been my portable drive with my portable computer. So, you know, it's been used with this computer. I don't know why it suddenly stopped.
Alan, it's Bob Walker here. I had the Transformer T100 Qi and a lovely little computer. Unfortunately, the monitor part, which has a computer in it and the keyboard, there was no connectors along the hinge. It was all done by Bluetooth. And in one of the Windows updates, it killed the Bluetooth radio in the device. And despite trying to go back to earlier versions of Windows 10, I was never able to get the device working again. So it recently joined the pile at the e-waste at the trail. And it was just too bad because it really was a nice little computer.
Yeah, they're really handy for traveling.
Well, mine has a GPS in it so that you can run Microsoft Maps and have updates all the time as a tablet or a laptop.
That's a nice feature.
Okay, well, I'll report back on that if I ever find out the problem.
If anybody has any ideas, even if you can't think of it tonight, if you think about it before next Wednesday, by all means, send it into suggestion box, and we can add it in as a follow-up.
My only suggestion for the 1 terabyte drive is that you check it on another computer and run, check drive and so on, and make sure that it's all nice, and then plug it into your T100. There's also, I think, on the T100, there's one thing on the keyboard and one on the tablet part. You might try using either of those to see what if it makes if they work. The other thing is that does your 1 terabyte drive have a plug that has like 2 plugs for extra power?
No.
Okay.
And now, my USB 100 only has 1 USB port on the keyboard. Anyway, I'll play around with the drives and see what's going on. Okay, so we're at that point. Anybody else have other questions, any comments, anything you would like to share? We still have 12 minutes.
I have one odd problem. I have, as well as this T100, I have another Chinese laptop that it said that I could, I decided foolishly to put a password on the BIOS for when it starts up. And it said it could be anywhere from, 8 to 20 characters. So I put in 20 characters. And now it won't start.
Oh, no.
I don't suppose, aside from, the only thing I can think of is take it apart, take out the battery that it has, a little battery that it has in it, and let it all reset, and maybe it'll come back to no BIOS password, but... that's about the only thing I can think of.
Yeah, that's about all I can think of as well. Or short of that, there's often you can short off two pins or something like that. If you can find any documentation for it, sometimes just shorting across two pins will zero that out rather than trying to remove the battery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't seen anything. It's a Chewy Hi 12. It's a nice laptop, except slow. And
I'll real slow now.
And if there's any way to return it to factory settings.
Yeah, I'd be happy with that.
Yeah.
I'll try that. Maybe there is a way. It's a good idea.
Okay, there's Joss has a question. If we have time to debug a Win10 update problem, I was asked to run a command into the command prompt admin, but all I can see is PowerShell admin. If you just click on the start button and then just type in CMD, you will have in the results, the top of the results window will be the command prompt. And if you right-click on that, you will get an option to run as admin.
I think the question was whether command or PowerShell are the same, and I don't know the real answer to this. My thinking is that PowerShell is just a superset of commands compared to a regular command shell.
Yeah, it is, but you don't execute things the same way, though. So if you're just needing to run a program, you don't run it the same way under PowerShell as you would under a command shell.
No, that's right. It needs a dot slash like the Linux commands.
Yeah.
Yeah. From what I understand,
I think if the command runs in PowerShell and it seems to work okay, it's probably all right. I mean, I think they're compatible in that respect.
Yeah. As far as I could tell, the command was working fine, and I got an error result from it. But I was just wondering if it was equivalent enough to be able to use that one instead of using the old command prompt.
Yeah, if you're getting if you were asked to run a command in the command prompt under admin rights, then that's what I would do. I just click on start, type in CMD, and then when you see the results window that comes up, just right click it and choose run as admin.
Okay.
And that'll be under the command prompt. You'll be running admin.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. By the way, I was able to fix my problem with the thing, but it was quite an adventure, I tell you.
Sometimes they are. Okay, if we don't have anything else, then as Alan has put up on the screen, I'll be happy to give just a little presentation on a Logitech Spotlight presenter, which is outrageously expensive, but a way cool tool if you have a need for giving presentations, and especially if you have a need for giving a lot of presentations. So I'm going to take over the sharing of the screen. And so I'll have just a little bit of a deck I'm going through. So there are a lot of presenter tools around. So you have, typically they'll have a laser pointer, and they will have keys that are useful for PowerPoint presentations, for next slide, previous slide, blank the screen, start the presentation, things like that. So your average presenter has global features such as, I've got a auto advancing on this, sorry. So your average presenter has features like laser pointer, the timer you'll sometimes have on them so that you can time your presentations. They usually run off of a USB receiver, and sometimes they'll do Bluetooth or sometimes they'll do both. And usually they don't have rechargeable batteries, so you usually have to use AA's or sometimes AAA batteries to power them. In the controls for PowerPoint, you'll always have next and previous slide, launching the screen show, potentially ending the screen show, and blanking the screen. There'll be keys for that. One of the things I don't like about your average presenter is that the laser doesn't work on a TV. So if you're presenting and you're connected up to a large screen TV or something like that, the laser pointer doesn't work on it. it needs that sort of reflective screen that you get when you're projecting onto a screen. And laser doesn't work over video conferencing. The prices are pretty cheap. So you can get no-name brand ones for $25 to $50. These are just some prices I got off of Amazon Canada. And if you want name brand ones, the price generally runs up around $50 to $80, and that you'll get Logitech or Kensington. I went and I saw this Logitech Spotlight, and it is really cool. Now, as I said, it's outrageously expensive. List price on Logitech Canada site is $150. You can get it at Amazon Canada for $110, but that's a little bit much. But it is a really cool device. So it uses USB and low-energy Bluetooth, so you can connect it up either ways. It does have rechargeable batteries that they say last 3 months, and it charges over a USB. So that thing that you see down at the bottom, that actually pulls out, and inside that is a little USB type A receiver, type C receiver, and you can plug in a cable into there, and they say that charging it over the USB, 1 minute will give you 3 hours presenting, which is really cool, because if you're about to present and all of a sudden you discover that it's dead, 1 minute charge will get you through pretty much any presentation that anybody's willing to sit through. It does have redefinable buttons, and it does not have a laser. But what it has instead is a virtual laser pointer, highlighter, or magnifier. And on those, you can modify the size, the brightness, and the color of each of them. Works on any display, and it works over video conferencing. So there is a... right now, I'm showing you in spotlight mode. Well, let me actually just double-click. Okay, so I just double-clicked the button, and now I'm in the virtual magnifier mode. So as I move this around, you know, it'll highlight some area on the screen and enlarge it. And I can modify the color of the outside circle. I can modify the size of the circle. I can't change the amount of magnification. There is a virtual laser pointer, so it's in this mode here. And when I'm in that mode, I can modify the color of the laser and the size of the laser, and it always has that fade off to the edges. And then there's the virtual highlighter, which I'm now showing on this, where you can change the size of the circle and you can change the contrast of the background. So the circle itself will always be the brightness that was originally there, and you can modify the outside of the circle, how dim that actually gets. And that's it. So going back to my start on that. So I will bring up just very briefly now, can everybody see that spotlight in the center of the screen?
Yeah.
Menu? Okay. I wasn't sure whether that was left only to me. So if I go on there, under here, I can put in all kinds of timers. I can have it vibrate after 15 minutes or 5 minutes before the end or whatever I want. There's a number in there. And then the main thing in here is the pointer. And you can come in and you can actually click on, so for highlight, I can change the size of it. So there's that size. And now if I bring it up bigger, actually I'm not sure that was really taking. Let's try bringing it right down.
It's obviously not the size. It's
the contrast. Sorry, yes. So there's the minimum contrast difference, and then there is bringing the maximum contrast difference. And then I can change the size up to something that is really big, down to something that is much smaller. Oops, I double-clicked it. There. So I can change that. You can also actually change it so that you actually can use it to click on something, and that's the cursor control. So I can point at something and then click with the pointer, and it'll actually be like a mouse click. So you have that effect there, and then under the magnify, you have the color, and then you have the size. And then under the laser, we have the color of the laser. You can set it to anything that you want, and you can set the size of it. So there I could drag this up, for example, to something really large, and there's my pointer at that, going down to very small, and I have something really tiny. So overall, and this is where I can customize the buttons. So the next button on the pointer, I can customize it. I have it set to start a presentation. You can have it do all kinds of things, including custom keystroke. So you could do Shift-Control-F5 or whatever you want for the buttons. And then the back button, you can customize that as well. And here it tells you that it's fully charged, which it's been sitting pretty much unused for about a month now. And it's still showing as being fully charged. So that's kind of nice. So neat little presentation tool. If you do a lot of presentations and you don't choke too badly at $110 to $150 price tag, I can highly recommend it.
Have you used Zoomit from SysInternals?
Yes, I have. And what I like, I guess, about this is the idea of the laser pointer or the magnifier or the highlighter. To me, it works better than just the SysInternals way of doing things. They both get the job done, I guess, but this allows you to really point out something on the screen, and it's really cool that it'll work over video conferencing.
Well, it's certainly Zoomit is not in your hand unless you have something that will interact with it as a mouse. But you can draw circles around things. You can do, I think, more than you can with that particular pointer.
Yeah.
And it has one timer that is you can use in between presentations. Basically, it's a countdown timer.
Yeah, it's not something that can just tell you about whether you're coming up to the end of your presentation sort of thing.
No, I'll put a link to it in the chat.
Yeah, I've used Zoomit before, and it's definitely very useful. But I thought this was a cool presentation tool, and I give a lot of presentations, not so much now since the pandemic, but I give hundreds of presentations, so it's a pretty neat tool for it. Anybody else have anything? We're just actually on 8:32, so I guess we should call it a night, but just before we do so, are there any last-minute things that people have?
So there's nothing like next Wednesday, I presume?
Yep.
It's coming up.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so the thing is coming up, our main monthly meeting will be September the 9th, Raspberry Pi. That will again be a Zoom conference. The tech cafes are starting up again in the fall. And the first one in the series is Chris's Windows Performance Tune-Up, which will be on the 14th. And the final thing is we do have a Q&A session on September the 2nd. So if you have questions, answers, or anything you want to share, send them along to suggestion box. And thank you very much for attending tonight.
Thanks very much, folks. We will have the presentation files and the audio file up within a day or so on our website. Thanks very much for attending, and hope to see you all next week.
Thank you, everyone. Great presentation tonight.
Thank you, one and all.
Yep, thank you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.